Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 6. It's great to have you. Podcasts 1 to 5 explored Australia's first science fiction story, Australia Advanced. Written in 1832, predicting Australia in 2032, you might have been delighted with advanced gas lamp lighting across vast cities and massive networks of steamships ploughing through the seas. This story set the stage for other stories that predicted the future and may have even influenced Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, 1887 to 2000, which came out in 1888. With the advent of electricity and the plethora of inventions in the late 19th century, what we consider to be real science fiction today first began to appear in Australian newspapers more so than as published novels. Australia's science fiction golden age, defined as being between 1901 and 1930, a time when many foundational science fiction texts appeared in Australian newspapers, is when not only Australian scientific fiction was popular with people across the country, but also a time when many recognisable subgenres of science fiction began appearing. While many of these stories revolved around an advanced chemical, biological or mechanical invention that was going to change the world, written in a plausible way with a modicum of accurate science, the story was usually contemporary, set in the near future, more often than not including a romance. From the 1830s onwards, in newspaper articles, these kinds of stories were most commonly referred to as scientific romances. Then from the 1870s, scientific fiction, as well as science and fiction, from the 1890s. While the term science fiction was originally used in 1851 in a book by William Wilson to describe a story featuring botanical science, the term didn't start appearing in newspapers until the 1930s. For the early part of the 20th century, scientific fiction is an ideal description for these stories and suggests a bit of flexibility with the number of inventions, the descriptions of science, and how the devices affect the narrative. Now, you're probably wondering about the story I've chosen. Well, I should first point out that George Griffith in the UK was already writing space opera in 1899 and had his space opera story Honeymoon in Space serialized in Pearson's Magazine in early 1900. Honeymoon in Space was released as a novel in Australia in 1901 and gained a lot of attention with reviews in multiple newspapers across the country. This title no doubt encouraged our authors to try their hand at space opera. Even so, Griffith can't get the credit for launching space opera in Australia. A story came out before that, called The World's Last Wonder, serialised in The Tocsin in 1901, so written before George Griffith's story could have been published here. It tells the tale of an invention enabling two residents from Melbourne to travel to Mars, with detailed scientific explanations and an accurate understanding of space physics. As a bonus, it includes an altercation about land rights with the spider elders of the humanoid insect tribes of Mars, resulting in Earth being quarantined. All of this from over 120 years ago. The downside of this story? No one knows who wrote it. I conducted stylometric tests comparing 320 articles from The Tocsin to chapters from The World's Last Wonder, and the tools suggest that Bernard Patrick O'Dowd might have written it. Close reading of these similar articles show a similarity of writing style, structure, and vocabulary use. O'Dowd's biography suggests an interest in science. However, his close friend and then editor John Arthur Andrews may have contributed the sections on invention, language, and interpretation. There is also a feminine element that isn't common in testosterone-driven scientific stories of the time, which suggests that a close female may have helped. A most likely candidate would be O'Dowd's then-wife, Evangeline Mina Fryer. In any case, enough rambling. Here is the first chapter of The World's Last Wonder, first published on 14th of February, 1901.
The World's Last Wonder. Unattributed author, possible author collaboration, Bernard O'Dowd and John Andrews, Chapter 1. I was sitting in my room, or what by a polite fiction was called mine. In reality, it belonged to somebody else, whose sole business on earth was to extort a charge from other people for leave to be on a particular part of it. As for myself, it appeared just then that I had no business on earth at all, although it appeared just as certain that I could not get away from the earth. How Sir Mark Solomon came to own my room was thus. In the early days his father desired to be somewhere and paid a government official a small sum for eternal permission to be within all that piece or parcel of land upon which the house now stands. Having done this, he proceeded to let off allotments on which other people desired to come. Having bought off the government from sending a force to expel him from the area, He had acquired thereby, according to the traditions of the times, the privilege of expelling anyone else who did not buy him off from doing so. They put up their humpies on the allotments, and with the rents they paid, he employed regular builders to erect him a mansion. After a time, this was considered too antiquated, and the Solomons moved out. Old Solomon sold it on time payment to one smith, who, when the old fellow died, had paid off all but a little. Sir Mark, who was plain Mark then, thereupon hit upon the brilliant idea of remarking to Smith's employer that these D.D. Unionists needed to be sat on, as the result of which Smith was locked out long enough to miss a payment and forfeit the lot. He disappeared, and Mark started a land boom, followed up at a suitable distance of time by an adroitly precipitated industrial conflict. For the glory and sanctification of the riches thus acquired, Mark was made Sir Mark. In fact, he manifested throughout all his dealings a genius far more brilliant than his father ever possessed, and he chose for his associates men of genius, financial and otherwise, amongst whom the otherwise portion was, quite casually, my friend Apollo Jones. How any man could be capable of genius under the blighting influence of such a name was treated as a mystery. We commonly dropped the Jones to make it still more unintelligible. Despite of being called Apollo, and of at the same time being rather good-looking, Jones grew up not to pride himself upon his appearance, but to neglect it, devoting all his attention instead to scientific experiments. As I have said, I was sitting in my room, or rather Sir Mark's, and deploring the fact that I seemed to have no business on earth, although I was not aware of having business anywhere else, and if I had been so aware, could not have found how to get away to it. Whilst I was thus engaged, there came a knock at the door, and without waiting for me to reply, Apollo entered, laboring evidently under some powerful excitement. "The infernal scoundrels!" he shouted, holding out towards me a slip of printed paper. "Look, what do you think of that?" I could not guess at his agitation, and grasped the cutting to obtain enlightenment. At the first reading, it did not convey much explanation. It was a brief announcement that letters patent had been granted to Arcturus G. Fisher, of New York, and Sir Mark Solomon, of Melbourne, in respect of invention already duly patented in the United States and throughout Europe, for a power capable of continuous application, without the intervention of mechanism attached to the ground, for the purpose of raising and sustaining weights above the earth's surface. "Well?" I asked, looking up. "Well," he retorted, choking with indignation, "well, of course, that comes of treating these financiers as decent, honest people." "Do you mean to say that a man of your scientific attainments has been guilty of any such folly?" I queried. "Unfortunately, yes," he replied, "or at least I assumed that for the particular occasion, the financier would not have understanding enough to be dishonest. I invent this, and while I am yet making an enlarged practical mode, he patents the whole thing over my head." "But surely," I remarked, "it can be contested and upset, though of course that is a matter of money." "You don't understand," answered Apollo. "I believe the steel is so barefaced that it can easily be knocked on the head, but until that is done, he and Fisher will possess the monopoly. Now I have reason to believe that what they want is not so much the apparatus as a commercial asset in itself, but simply the first use of it as a means of reaching certain previously inaccessible resources of which to take possession. By making these resources their property, they will be able to appropriate just as much of the advantage which the invention, in making those resources accessible, creates, as if they did not own the resources, but succeeded in unjustly monopolizing the means of reaching them." "That," I said, "is logical. If you have reason to believe that there is a brick of gold on the top of the chimney, it may be more profitable to annex the top of the chimney by means of a stolen ladder than to own the ladder. But still, all this is very vague, and if, as I suppose, you want to discuss ways and means of circumventing the enemy, it will be necessary to come down to detail." Then he told me a story that fairly took my breath away. The gist of it was that he had discovered a force capable of acting constantly and directly against that of gravitation, and therefore able, not only, as the report modestly set forth, to lift and sustain weights without the intervention of material supports, but also to propel and steer, if required, a suitably constructed car out into the depths of space and pass from planet to planet, limited only by time. And this was the application that he had spoken of to Sir Mark. The latter, he believed, had sufficiently grasped the details to cause a power generator to be built, and probably the piratical patenting was intended as a blind to the real purpose of the robber, namely, as Apollo firmly asserted, to take possession of space and the planets with all their untouched natural store in the name of the Solomon Fisher Syndicate. I must admit that I then believed Apollo to have become raving mad. My face must have expressed my opinion very clearly. However, he declared that I should see the invention forthwith, which, whilst incomplete, he had kept from my knowledge on purpose, because I was such an incredulous cynic. And he assured me that if within 2 hours I had not been convinced of my error, he would cheerfully submit to be led away to a lunatic asylum. Perfectly decided in my own mind that one of these two things must result, and with very little room for the opinion that it might not after all be the latter, I put on my hat and accompanied him forth to what he was wont to call his laboratory. Chapter 2. As soon as we entered the laboratory, Apollo pointed out to me a small concern about the size of a drainpipe, thickly festooned with a tangle of wires and bearing not the least suggestion of the purpose for which it might be intended. "Here," he said quietly, "is the germ of the invention. Whilst experimenting with certain obscure forms of light and electricity, I chanced to notice that a part of the apparatus became unsteady. Upon investigating, I found that this could only be attributed to some action of the rays which were being emitted from the lower surface, which, in other words, was sending out waves of energy capable of affecting matter, not alone molecularly, but in the mass, and exercising a reaction of thrust against their source. Had the radiator been securely fastened instead of merely resting on a stand, I should have missed the discovery. Not only because the unsteadiness gave the indication, but you shall see." He turned a lever, and the strange apparatus, after a momentary hesitation, slowly rose from the table and pressed against the ceiling. A string enabled him to turn the lever partly back, and the thing slowly descended. At his suggestion, I placed my hand on the top of it. It was quite hot, but presently cooled again, and he then sent it up a second time, not allowing it to reach the ceiling, when upon its descent I found it, somewhat to my surprise, to be perfectly cold. "There lies the secret," he exclaimed. "The force must have been evolved at times by other experimenters, and yet they could not detect it. Why? Because a very slight resistance to its thrust decomposes it into heat. This first apparatus that you see before you cannot lift 1 ounce more than its own weight, even slowly. It would simply cease to press down for a moment, and then generate heat which, by accumulating, would stop the action and give back its practical weight. Another ounce yet, and it would not even appear to lose heaviness. The essential waves would be checked from the outset, and nothing whatever but heat could be produced. Then," I said, "how can it possibly raise a load?" "Ah, that leads to something. Why do you not ask how the slow speed you have witnessed can be of any use to make a journey to Mars? One would get grey-headed in going to the top of Scott's Church even. So I should think," was my candid comment. "But," replied Apollo, "by modifying the apparatus in later improved models, I have been able to evolve more energetic force waves, and even that is not the best of it. Ah, the beauty of this thing is precisely in what you took for its weak point. Do you not see that motion against the thrust must have the same effect as an additional weight? Well then, conversely, motion with the thrust increases the effective generation of the force, and so the power and speed go on increasing. Besides, the resistance of gravity decreases as the square of the distance increases, and thus in a double manner aids the effect. then the whole concern becomes, instead of a heat producer, a mighty refrigerator. Instead of its force tending to leak off into heat, every vibration of heat that it can snatch up is greedily swallowed, digested, and transmuted into force. There is no need to carry a great load of appliances charged with stored-up generative power. The sun will furnish all that is needed as soon as the speed, the activity, passes a certain critical minimum. Why then, I objected, your machine would freeze you to death. Yes, he replied, if it were allowed. But I have found an insulator which, though it does not arrest the ordinary escape of heat, absolutely shuts off the peculiar suction of it exerted by the apparatus. Then he abruptly turned the conversation by showing me another printed slip, which read, Mr. Arcturus G. Fisher, who in conjunction with an Australian millionaire has developed a new form of ascensional motor and aerial elevator, made a successful trial trip of the invention yesterday, rising from Brooklyn to an invisible height and remaining aloft for several hours, afterwards descending at precisely the spot previously selected. His patron will cross from Australia shortly, when the machine, with a few alterations suggested by interim trials, will be used for an expedition the nature of which is to be kept secret, but from which extraordinary results are anticipated. I could not see that this justified the wild suspicion, or rather absolute conviction, which Apollo had expressed as to the pair's destination, but I contented myself with inquiring, Do you know who this Arcturus G. Fisher is? Don't you, said Apollo. Why, he is the man who stole sausages. The what? Surely you can't read the papers. Arcturus G. Fisher was proprietor of a big butchery small goods factory. It occurred to him that everybody asked for sausages as sausages, and so, he reasoned, if he could appropriate that word for his own trademark, no dealer would be allowed to supply any other than Arcturus G. Fisher's sausages when sausages were asked for. He went for it, and he got it too, let me tell you, not only in the States but all over the world. And the consequences is that all the other sausage makers are now advertising their sausages as steak pudding, or mincena, or meat flour, or something equally mysterious to the general public, who, ignorant of the legal decision, still persist in calling a sausage, and do not know why it should be called anything else. If you had read the case, you would remember that the celebrated counsel, Dr. Mizena, appeared for the plaintiff in his action to restrain a local butcher for selling sausages as sausages. That seems to surprise you, but the thing is a notorious fact. Great heavens, I cried, and do you mean to say our Victorian court permitted such an infamous steal, robbing people of the very words of their language, which they learned at school from their old-fashioned spelling books? Why, next thing some American scoundrel will take out a patent for the common process of kissing one's girl, or get a court verdict that every woman who wants to be living in legal matrimony must be married to him. And what else, I wonder? At any rate, said Apollo, you do not any longer think the project of a trip, say to Mars, with a view of annexing it bodily, any too colossal for him. Goodness no! But after all, do you seriously maintain that it is practicable? Mere possibility is hardly enough. Granting so much, what would be the advantage, when at best the trip must occupy something like a lifetime? Not so long, replied Apollo, for this force is in effect a conversion of molecular vibration into mass movement. Every other motive power merely exchanges one kind of molecular vibration for another and converts the difference of space needed into an equivalent of secular translation. Here it is not a question of the space required for molecular movements, but of their synchronizing in a common and uniform direction. Explain the explanation, I requested. Well, take the common gases. The movement of their particles amongst each other, which makes them gases, is, for some which are not the swiftest either, 2 or 3 miles a second per particle. If instead of that movement being expended in dodging hither and thither amongst other particles, it were run out in a straight line, it would reach Mars in about 6 months. Say we get only a speed of a mile a second, then at the maximum perigee distance, the journey would take less than 2 years. But a mile a second, you might as well talk of being shot out of a cannon. Nonsense. You can work up to it from a mile an hour by increases of a rate of a mile an hour each, one increase every 10 seconds in 36,000 seconds, 600 minutes or 10 hours. What better do you want than that? Really, said I, rashly and little thinking how soon I should be called upon to fulfill my words. If you ever get to the stage of organizing an interplanetary excursion, you can count upon me to accompany you. Your hand on that, he said. It is the very thing I was going to ask you. I have perfected the radio motor and built a car quite suitable for the purpose. In fact, I have ruined myself to build it, and hope to have it fitted up in readiness within 6 weeks. The thing must be done. I have certain word that Fisher and Solomon have fixed the date of their expedition for just 7 weeks hence, and whether they go to Tibet, or the South Pole, or the Moon, or to Mars, I am firmly resolved to be on their track and come in beforehand. He then took me a journey to where the wonderful car was being fitted. This car I shall soon take occasion to describe. And at the sight of the vast and elaborate preparations that were being made, I felt that I was indeed in for it. I did not quite relish the prospect, which was certainly of a sort to try the strength of one's nerves, but it was not to my liking to draw back, and with, as I had already painfully realized, no particular business on the earth, why should L not plunge boldly? Besides, after all, adventure has powerful attractions. So for the next 6 weeks, I occupied myself in turning my small worldly possessions into money and the money into equipment for the strange voyage, under the advice and suggestion of my leader, Apollo Jones.
I hope you enjoyed chapters 1 and 2 of The World's Last Wonder. On Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast, episode 7, chapters 3 and 4, explore the insides of the space car, feature a visit to Brooklyn, New York, and describes the unexpected addition of an American member to the crew. Thank you for listening.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.